Look through the hatch.
Leash is landlocked, but water runs through it, as barge operator Philip Crean knows very well.
So you'd be steering back here on the tiller.
Mm-hmm.
Then over here, then you have all your controls. Would we go for a spin?
Why, oh, definitely.
Okay, good stuff. I'll
get
the keys.
That has to be done. That has to be done.
Okay, yeah. I'll just get the key up here.
From here in Phillips Vicarstown base, you can reach almost all of it. The Barrow, the Nore, the Owen Ass, a stretch of the Grand Canal. That water carries you into what was O'Moore country and Queen's County, through calm flatlands, prosperous farms, close to the edges of once thriving industrial towns like Mount Mellick, the Manchester of Ireland in its day.
Go straight now.
Imagine the great forests felled, the timber carried down river to Waterford and across to Bristol to build ships for the British Navy and the expansion of empire.
It was this really busy hub then of commerce and communication.
Oh yeah. And it's all because of the Grand Canal. They finished this stretch, I think, in 1795 or something around that time. And from Dublin they'd bring down Porter and...
Manure from Dublin, the dung trade, wasn't that what it was called?
Yeah, spread on the land around, which
from
was great.
The street horses in Dublin, exactly, of course, should make for good land around here. The building of the canal gave a huge amount of work, didn't it?
Oh yeah. On this particular line, the Barrow line of the Grand Canal, there was 4,000 labourers working, navvies, they used to call them in those days,
digging out the canal by shoveling. Yeah.
No such thing as a JCB.
They were the JCBs, weren't they?
Yeah.
There's so much evidence of history and settlement everywhere in this county. You can almost touch the webs of connection and time. You're listening to The County Measure. I'm Vincent Woods. We're making a journey around Ireland 100 years after independence and partition to get a measure, to get many measures of all 32 counties. We're looking at place, landscape, and the people who shape their lives within these boundaries of community and county. In this series, I'm hoping to get a fresh understanding of each county and its people as we shape a radio atlas of Ireland. Port Arlington straddles the border between Leash and Offaly. All the patterns of early town planning are here. Long, linear streets, a now abandoned market house.
It would be so lovely, that building.
And history is here in the names. The English church, and separate to it, the French church. A small but vital clue to an unexpected strain of settlement and connection between this town and France. I make my way to the French Quarter Café.
La vie est trop courte pour boire du vin mauvais.
Life's too short to drink bad wine. Well, I couldn't agree more.
There I meet John Stocks Powell and David Orford.
Hello.
Hello.
Two local historians who bring Port Arlington's French history to life.
John, David, I'm intrigued to discover more about this very, very strong French connection to the town. And David, you might tell us a little bit about that.
Certainly. Well, I suppose Port Arlington has long had a reputation as having a French connection, and that connection goes back to the time of the Battle of the Boyne. And the French who settled here were mainly soldiers who fought on the side of William of Orange at the Battle of the Boyne under a guy called Henry de Massou de Ruvigny. And following the Battle of the Boyne, he was granted the area where Port Arlington now stands. It had been an English settlement which hadn't been very successful. It had been set up by Henry Bennet, who had the title of Lord Arlington, hence the name Port Arlington, but not very successful. It had gone into serious decline. And Ruvigny decided that he had all these French soldiers who would come here. He didn't know what to do with them, so he thought, I'd grant them leases on the land in Port Arlington. And hence, from about, I suppose, 1691 onwards, for probably 10, 15 years, we had French Huguenots coming to settle in the town.
So they, as French Protestants, were being persecuted.
They were being persecuted in France. And I suppose it is unique in that for a short period of time, French would have been the everyday spoken language in the town because the French settlers were in the majority. There were very few English settlers left. And as far as we can see, there was very little hostility towards them. They were more or less welcomed. I think they were bringing a new lease of life to the town. And certainly from even looking at the registers of the French church, we see that they quickly began to intermarry with the Irish. French mademoiselles in the town was a big novelty.
I think some of them had to learn Irish because there were some Huguenots planted out Clanagowan way. There was certainly one Huguenot family that were tanners. And if they had to deal with men from the hills with the cattle and tanning, they probably had to learn Irish, let alone English.
And, of course, the original name for Port Arlington is Coolantoodhru.
Yes.
Which is, again, the tanning reference. Tanning.
Exactly. Yeah. The tanning pits weren't found just off Main Street.
And then it became something of a centre of education, John. And
it did.
Were there four boys' schools at one point?
Oh, there were lots more schools than that. From the 1750s right through to the 1820s. They would come to Port Arlington to learn French, but also to learn Latin and Greek, the classics, dancing, fencing. And we've one or two famous people. One was Edward Carson, the great prosecutor of Oscar Wilde, and of course the man, Home Rule means Rome Rule. And he was at school here.
David, what traces have remained? I mean, did anything survive in terms of architecture or, written documents, sort of anything that gives us that sense of continuity?
Yeah, well, I suppose the most important item of the registers of the French church, but there are documents, and John has recorded a lot of documents, and especially information in relation to the schools. And, of course, the French Huguenots that settled here, in general, as far as we know, were not craftspeople. They weren't silversmiths. They were mainly people from a military background, and many of them would have been from a farming background. So there was no great craft industries. We don't have Port Arlington silver.
The memory is strong, though, isn't it? The memory of the connection, at least. Was there a French festival here?
Yes, certainly. In the 1970s, a local committee came together and started a French festival. And we had French dancers coming over here. We had a snail-eating competition, which probably wouldn't be very acceptable nowadays. I think everybody really in the town is very conscious of the French connection.
The ambassador was here
as recently as a couple of months ago. He was actually in this cafe here, and he went into the French church and he saw the French registers, and he actually met some of the descendants of the original Huguenot settlers. So yes, I think the French connection is still very much alive in Port Arlington.
For centuries, people have been coming to Laois from many corners of the world.
Now, as you go, start to warm up, we will start from Arabian.
People come here still and make new lives, their stories embroidering into the story of this county.
One, two, three.
And in the case of a classical ballet dancer from Lithuania, teaching the art of dance in towns like Killinard forges all kinds of new connections.
My name is Shviesa and my surname is Joha. And we are in Dancing Jewels Ballet School.
One, two, three.
When I was 10, I studied in a professional ballet school.
So we'll do this one three times.
And studied there 8 years.
And then we go to one side and stretch back.
To be a professional dancer, you need to love what you do.
And come back.
You start from 10 o'clock, you work, you do your class, then you practice, you rehearsal. And of course, in my country was not enough money, so I would go to the next job to do a teaching. Then I go back quickly to my practices at 6 o'clock to 9, or I would have a performance. So you need to be really tough inside you.
The same you continue with right, again left, and again right. Then we take right leg and just we go bounce up.
The nicest thing about ballet is it's very graceful and beautiful. And personally, when I dance, I feel free. This is called a classical pose, where you have your left arm up and then your right arm to the side.
We will put our leg on the bar, high up.
One of the most difficult things for me is stretching and like trying to lift my leg as high up as I can, because for me it's really hard.
And then I think it will be time to come to our swing back. Very nice swing.
The strength that they put into their allegros, into their jumps and their turns, it is incredible. I think it's not everybody can do those revoltats and some other turns.
Four, and we go back.
It is not always, I would say, a road paved with roses. You need to work, work and work and work.
I think my best day would have been the days on the show. The excitement of going on stage, remembering your dances and hearing the music and getting to see your family in the audience. There's a lot of emotions, and you can get very nervous, but it's always so much fun.
You're listening to The County Measure with Vincent Woods. We're in County Leash. Abbey Leaks, Port Arlington, Rosanallis, Boris and Ossory, Port Leash, Mount Rath. These names have a symmetry and strength. They're like building blocks of sound to match the built landscape.
The old and the new on the right-hand side of the road as we leave Mount Mellick, ruins of an old mill, the many mills around here, and then on the left, an apple green filling station.
Mount Mellick was once a thriving industrial centre. It was known as the Manchester of Ireland, and much of this industry was founded by Quakers. Despite the noise of industry, the Quaker heritage of Leash is a quiet one. These were good people, and many of them rest in a lovely spot near the town of Rosanallis, in the oldest Quaker graveyard in Ireland, the Friends' sleeping place.
Hello, Vincent.
Vincent, welcome to Rosanallis.
Here I meet Christopher Pym, caretaker of the cemetery and descendant of one of the oldest Quaker families in Leash.
So this would actually be my family. My dad is over there, my granny, my uncle, or my granddad, I should say. So my uncle and aunt who just died recently. William Edmondson, who was the first Quaker to come to Ireland, he brought Quakerism to Mount Mellick, which obviously is just down the road, 3 miles back into town. And along with him, there would have been five other families kind of came with him in around that time. And that would have been the 1650s, thereabouts, something like that.
And they did a lot of good work.
They certainly did, and obviously played a huge role in the famine. They have a tradition of kind of helping in a crisis, and so while they didn't go to war, or say they didn't fight in the war, and like my great-grandfather would have been, he did first aid during the war, so was obviously at the front line looking after people, but obviously didn't approve of picking up a gun to kill somebody else. So yeah, that was sort of a little bit of the ethos, is we would rather be caring and looking after people than killing one another.
But of course, what's so striking in the graveyard is that there's no hierarchy. Everyone really gets the same simple marker.
We're all equal in the eyes of God, in life as well as in death.
And in death as well as in life.
And in death as well, exactly. Yeah.
What do you think Quaker tradition has brought to this region?
Well, I don't know whether it's the Quaker tradition or the Quaker kind of work ethos, but it brought a huge amount of industry to the area. Literally any business you can imagine has seemed to have been run out of Mount Mellick at some stage, between tanneries and breweries and glue makers and candle makers and drapers, you name it. They seem to have a huge entrepreneurial flair, if that's the right word, but then doing it with an ethos where they care for the employee to a huge extent. And my grandmother, she was a Jacob, so obviously a massive connection with the cream crackers and the Kimberley Macados, and so, you know, so that goes back a long way. So, and they would have always had a tremendous history of looking after employees and sort of employee loyalty and stuff.
This graveyard will also feature in a new film set in 18th century Laois and produced by David Butler.
David, tell me about the film.
So it's called The Light Within. It's a family drama, essentially, set in kind of 1780s Ireland. The family are Quakers in their story. The mum of the family has passed away and she's in the Sleeping Friends graveyard. But there's a supernatural element to it as well. We're not Quakers ourselves, but we're very respectful and we're delighted to have permission from Quakers Ireland and the Payne family.
Christopher, that The Light Within, tell me a little bit about that concept.
The whole thing about the Quakerism and probably why they split from Protestantism was that just their wish was for it to be a much more simple transaction with God, if that makes any sense, so that it's very much a one-to-one experience and that there is no need for a clergyman to be involved in that process. And I suppose that really is the, in simple language, the biggest difference. There is no intermediary.
Another lovely Laois town is Rathdowney, with its elegant town square and a fine Church of Ireland church.
So we're here in the square in Rathdowney to see Adam Warren's wall mural, Spirit of Laois. And very vivid it is and colourful. Hurlers, cattle, tractor, river, a few people and the sun rising on the Spirit of Laois. It's great.
Admiring the mural, I meet local rector, the Reverend Richard Whiteley.
Hello.
Hiya, Vincent.
How do you do?
Good to meet you. Square is beautiful.
It is. And the town used to look so, when I first came here, so run down. And it's looking so much better now. And more things are happening all the time. So it's very, very encouraging.
He and some of his congregation are in the church, clearing away the offerings of fruit, vegetables and flowers after the recent Harvest Festival services.
And we have a lovely box of apples too. Cookers and eating apples. Beautiful. And still a few on the windows there.
Yeah, a few potatoes up there.
They're lovely. Aren't they lovely?
Yeah. It's all over for another year now.
Indeed. Well, yes. This is.
I thought the decorations were exceptional.
They were beautiful.
They were so well done.
Yeah.
The organ is rather lovely too, isn't
it?
Yeah,
it's lovely, but there's no one to play it anymore.
Isn't it? Isn't
it? Be soon, I think.
Yeah.
I hope there will be somebody
Bishop
to play it again.
Bishop Burroughs, did you ever hear of him?
Yes.
Michael Burroughs. Mm. The last time he was here, he said it should be played once a month. And my husband used to go over.
Traditions often fall into disuse or get lost in the speed of time and change, the urge towards the new. The making of St. Bridget's crosses is one tradition that has survived and adapted. But here in Laois, another detail of Bridget's life and legend is being reimagined and has the potential to become as iconic as the crosses of Rush and their elegant mix of craft and folk aesthetic. This new tradition involves St. Bridget's cloak, or the Brath Vrija. Rita O'Loughlin is the founder of the My Brath Vrija initiative.
Lovely to meet you.
And at the Makeport Innovation Hub in Port Arlington Business Park, I see an eye-catching Bridget's cloak hanging from a door.
We're upcycling pre-loved scarves and we're turning them into Bridget's cloaks. And we're asking people to gift them to people who are maybe feeling unwell or just make it for someone who they love.
It's very striking. It's just lovely. Yeah. There's a series of spirals and then hearts and these slightly abstract patterns and these beautiful long stitches. It's on a scarf that was originally kind of cream and shades of brown. And then you've put on these vivid colours of yellow and pink and blue and red and orange. Tell me a little bit, Rita, about the tradition of the Brathbridge, the, you know, Bridget, St. Bridget's cloak.
Well, my understanding, my mother was from the countryside. She was born and bred in Bonabrina. She would have always made scarves for people as gifts because she said years ago everybody wore a scarf and not everybody had a lot of money for medicine. And they had a firm belief in the healing powers of Bridget. So she would have made these and left them out on the eve of Bridget's Day because it was believed that Bridget passed over the land and imbued them all with healing powers. They'd keep them inside then in a special place and they'd be used all year if someone felt unwell, headache, they'd be wrapped in the Brathbridge. So she lived with me when I first moved down to Port Arlington from Dublin and we used to do them together and I used to give them to my friends. And when my mum passed away, I used all her scarves rather than giving them to a charity shop. I made Brathbridge for all my
friends.
So
it's honouring her as well and passing that tradition and power.
And I visually can see horse scarves on other people and it's lovely.
So you're bringing together, in a way you're bringing together memory, community, myth, and then the practicality of recycling and sustainability so that things are not just thrown out and dumped.
The thing about the group is that we're not just interested in one sector of the community. We want everybody to come together because too often a certain age group does work together and they're all in their own little groups and they not very often get a chance to actually kind of do things together, to speak together, share stories, talk about things they did before. That's what we're trying to initiate across Ireland at community level.
So you have youngsters, you have children, you have teenagers meeting with older people,
exactly.
All sharing this.
Sharing conversation and just becoming comfortable. And everybody's welcome. So it's not a thing where you have to have a membership for. Anyone that can come, man, woman, is welcome. Some of the stitches aren't perfect. That's not the point. Yeah. Every stitch is a good intention for the person who's going to wear it. So that's the main thing.
It's a wonderful idea. It's really lovely. I think you'd like to see this idea brought back of the cloak, Bridget's cloak, especially in conjunction with the bank holiday in honour of her, named for her on the day. Yes,
I'd love to go across Ireland at a community level. People just coming together, chatting and talking. Let Bridget bring them together. But the conversations are happening. You know, there's too many people living out by themselves, afraid. It brings people out of community.
And I think, did you find that with some of the Ukrainians who came to Ireland recently, that there's a similar idea?
There is a similar idea in their tradition. It's a short day embroidery for men who are working. They embroider the collars. Yeah, they have a similar tradition. Yeah, it's fantastic.
Can we cross the threshold now?
You can, because you know Bridget was born on the threshold. And so she's the goddess of the inner and the outer worlds. So she blesses the threshold. When you're leaving your house, she blesses you. And as you come back in, she blesses you as you come back in.
So it's entirely appropriate that we're standing
Absolutely.
On the threshold.
In the door, yes.
Step now, in now with great pleasure.
The scarf I'm making is made from alpaca yarn. The yarn has been handspun, naturally dyed. It will go to one of my friends who's actually quite sick.
I'm making mine for my mother. She's 86. She would absolutely love this and the concept behind it. It's made with love and you're wrapping that love around yourself.
I'm from Russia and it's scarf. It's for my friend from Ukraine.
My name is Brita Hogan. We're part of a Nectar Retirement Group.
My name is Fionn Connolly and I've stitched in a little circle and in the middle I have a cross for kind of protecting your family.
It's nice to potter away at a scarf, relax the mind and keep a good track on your mental health, I suppose.
Everybody's so positive and meeting during the week has been healthy for me in particular because I'm not working at the moment.
We're all mixed together and we're good company for each other and it made my day.
This is my Brathbridge. Every stitch is a beautiful intention. Every thread's imbued with love. Every thimble, every thread, every hand, every head, every flourish, every swirl, every boy, every girl. All new journeys start with one small step. Every blessed thread we weave tells us this is my community and this is my Brathbridge.
That was Derek Collins reading a poem he wrote to mark the launch of the My Brathbridge initiative. You're listening to The County Measure. We're in County Leash. Coming up, sporting spirit and digging the past. In search of red grouse on the Schlieve blooms, poet Pat Boren climbs into memory
at a new, young music group mine their new sound near Emo. The upland bogland, this raised bog on the Schlieve Blooms where Leash meets Offaly, is wild and fragile. A last remnant of the great forests that were here and the larger bogs that have now been supplanted by pine forests. This precious place is minded by the National Parks and Wildlife Service, by people like conservation ranger Robert Edge.
Hello, Robert.
It's a misty morning on the Schlieve Blooms, but the air is fresh and lovely to breathe in. The heather has faded to a pale purple-brown, shots of wildflower here and there.
We're standing in the car park at Ardern. We're going to head up this trail. It's a little bit rough. It'll be a little bit wet, but hopefully we'll see some grass.
In search of red grouse, we head up a steep track into the bog proper.
Heading straight into County Leash.
We'll stay on the right side of the boundary.
Exactly.
Yeah, exactly.
It's heavy and sodden, treacherous holes and gaps everywhere.
So the red grouse is native, isn't it?
Red grouse is native, yeah.
And the numbers have come down quite a bit, haven't they, in the last decades?
Yeah, in the last 40-odd years, the distribution and population has dropped by about 50%. This would be one of the strongholds, particularly in the Midlands. We hold something in the order of 5 to 7% of the national population here.
And is that reduction down to destruction of habitat largely?
Largely, yeah. That's predominantly it. It's habitat loss. And then we have commercial forestry either side. So it does create difficulties in trying to conserve the species.
That's eating into habitat again.
Eating into habitat, yeah.
It's the highest bit of bog I've ever been on.
Okay, yeah. You've got great views, you know.
Great vista around.
Down to the south-southwest. It's a lovely, lovely piece of the world.
We press on, stepping over diverse bogland with a rich and varied plant life. Robert stops and reaches for a slender green stalk.
This is bog rosemary.
Oh, that's rosemary.
Yeah.
Oh, bog rosemary. Beautiful.
And it generally is found on raised bogs.
Okay.
And this bog, being a blanket bog, it's unusual to find it here, but it is here and it's widespread across the site.
So you don't get the same really strong...
No.
Scent from it, and,
no.
and as you do.
Yeah.
Oh, rosemary. It's a lovely plant, though.
It is a lovely plant, and it's a lovely colour, you know.
And really strong, stem.
Exactly,
We'll walk on and
and
see where
fair enough, yeah.
Where we're taken to. Grouse are a beautiful bird, aren't they?
Yeah, the red grouse, it's kind of pigeon-sized, small, plump bird with a reddish-brown tinge to its feather or its plumage. The male has a very distinctive eyebrow, which is red.
Oh, what's the call like?
The call, well, I'm going to try and mimic it if I can. It's go back. It's very distinctive. If you hear that sound, you know you found a red grouse.
And it almost sounds like go back.
Go back, exactly.
Warning the human
keep,
away.
Keep away, yeah.
Yeah. How many pairs do you reckon there are?
Well, our spring count this year had around about 180 individuals. Now, we reckon that was an underestimate, and there's likely to be probably in the order of 240, 250.
And is that good? I mean, is that showing any kind of increase at all in the numbers?
There was a survey, a national survey 10 years ago, and this site would have been surveyed as part of that. That had the number pretty much the same as what we have now. So we have a stable population up here.
Robert points out that one of the hardest parts of red grouse conservation work is clearing away the non-native conifers that take root here and have the potential to destroy the bog habitat that the birds depend on.
We're just stopped here along the path and we can see a self-cedar conifer that's,
this tiny conifer creeping up.
Yeah, exactly. A bit of windblown.
It's creeping up, yeah.
Windblown seed has found a spot and
so you would dig that up.
We pull them up, yeah.
Further up, we encounter a drainage ditch with a barrier across it.
What are we looking at here? Is it kind of like a metal fencing here in the bog?
It's actually plastic. These are plastic dams. Uh-huh. There were plans, I guess, to try and drain this site for commercial forestry. Part of our habitat management is to try and block up those drains, to start holding the water and to re-wet areas that were dry or have been dry since they were drained. But we have kilometres of drains up here.
We move on again, keeping our ears open for that distinctive call. Finally, in the distance,
four grouse on the horizon, just to our left.
Fantastic. We spotted them.
Yeah, yeah.
The lesser spotted red grouse.
That's it. We got there eventually.
Robert, great to talk to you.
Yes,
great
to meet lovely, you. Yeah, lovely yeah. to talk to you too.
Great
yes,
work.
Yes.
Yeah.
Oh, sure, look, we're doing our bit, you know, so yeah, good. A lot to be done.
Excellent.
My name is Pat Boren. I'm a poet born and raised on the main street in Portlaoise. And this poem is called Hill Walking in Laois, and it's set 25, 30 years ago maybe, when I was still living in the area. But it's very much about a map for the present and the future. Into the Slieve Bloom foothills we set out. Like the Fianna, I imagined. Up the gentle incline through ferns and brambles, fir and Scots pine, a silver birch stood here or there, a standard raised above the green. I loved the claim that these were once the highest peaks in Europe, an alpine range on our very doorstep, a place that could still be seen, but only if you closed your eyes. Who would have guessed that the glittering ribbon that downstream became the Barrow, or the scattered rounded stones that lined its banks, were all that was left of those barely imaginable heights, of a glacier's grinding retreat and unstoppable force. These modest hills and winding paths were where we came for Sunday walks, parents, siblings, one and then a second family mutt. Leaving the house on Main Street, Portlaoise, then Laois itself, then the entire inhabited world behind, below, for what was as much pilgrimage as escape. A forest of close planted trees jostling for dominance in the fading light, and in the shade beneath, our intrepid band, wandering through destruction's aftermath. And now, well, now our parents too are gone. Or up here, as I like to think, in these ghost hills, on their vantage points just above the known, watching over us, willing us on, and now and again, holding back the brambles that we might pass. The abyss yawns, and mountains are ground to dust. Yet, for the most part, when we set out here side by side through late sunshine or early frost, the only sounds we heard were birdsong, our mother rehearsing the names of plants and trees, the rattle of pebbles on the would-be river's tongue, or my father's transistor radio that somehow out of the ether managed to receive the broadcast of the Sunday game. Those few fleeting moments out of all of geological time made sacred by his rapt attention. All lessons for the journey ahead, it seems to me, from the cautious descent to the next steep climb.
You're listening to The County Measure, and today we're in County Laois. Portlaoise, the town that was Maryborough, was founded in 1557 and is now the county town of Laois and one of the fastest growing urban centres in the country. It's an important commercial centre, Ireland's first designated inland port, known for its prison and home to offices for the Department of Agriculture and hubs for CIE, the ESB and UNPOST. And here, too, the very first centre, the remnants of the first garrison fort, the old Fort Protector, symbol of colonial power and occupation. This was the hub of the first plantation of Ireland during the reign of Queen Mary in the 1550s, thus Queen's County. This large square-walled fort enclosed roughly a hectare of land. Beside its imposing round bastion...
Hello, Sean, is it?
I meet Sean Murray.
So my name is Sean Murray. I'm a local archaeologist here from County Laois. I'm the chairman of the Laois Heritage Society. And we're standing here in Port Laois, just outside the old fort walls here in the town.
And this was the first Tudor fort, wasn't it, in Ireland?
Yeah, absolutely. This was the very first one that was built. So it was built in 1547, 48, in around that time. And it was built because it's a central location in County Laois. We have an old map of Laois. It's a plantation map from the 1560s. And if you look on the map, you can see like the fort and you can see a river here. And there's just beyond us here, there's an Esker Ridge running down along. And that would have connected this area here all the way to the Barrow and beyond. Of course, the Barrow would have been used as a river transportation system back then. There was plenty of woodlands here. There was gales hiding out in the woodlands as well. It wasn't kind of an ideal place for soldiers to be venturing out by themselves or anything like that, you know.
They wouldn't be going west of the Barrow.
They wouldn't be going west of the Barrow, exactly, you know. And we also have names of some of the first settlers that were in the town here. A lot of the names were Welsh kind of names. So we think, you know, there was a lot of kind of Welsh settlers that came to County Laois during the plantation period first. And they would have settled here, I suppose, from the Welsh marshes and things like that. There was Chapman and there was Good. White was another name. There's still some Whites living in Laois today, so who knows, maybe descendants of Tudor settlers.
Are you Laois originally?
I am, yeah. I was born in Port Laois. Yeah, not Marlborough, Port Laois.
Did your grandmother call it Marlborough?
She did, yeah, affectionately. She'd say it every now and again. Not all the time, but yeah, she would have done all right.
Again, it's how names linger in memory, you know.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I suppose, you know, her parents would have been referring it to Marlborough more frequently, I suppose, you know, so it's true.
And for you, Sean, I wonder, you know, if you were asked to sum up some kind of spirit of Laois or what it means, what would you think of?
Well, I suppose the spirit of Laois for me would be, I mean, we're standing outside the fort here, like, I suppose, and if you look at the high walls of the fort, you can kind of see, you know, that the Tudors came to town here. They were obviously quite afraid of the locals, and I suppose there was a kind of a rebellion with Laois, you know, with the Gaels here. You know, I just think the fort, although it is a plantation fort and it's a symbol of English encroachment into Gaelic lands here, it's also a kind of a monument to really keep the Gaels out as well, so you know, it's important that way.
And it was a monument too to that spirit of defiance, of rebellion.
Absolutely, yeah, no, it's the great kind of monument here that we have in Port Laois, and you know, it's important.
Laois, I think, doesn't have a county museum yet. I presume that that's something you'd like to see and something that would reflect the history of the fort in particular.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's something that the Laois Heritage Society have been kind of championing for a long time, and I think this would be a great location here. It's kind of like the cultural quarter now of the town. It'd be nice to have a museum maybe or an interpretive centre within the walls of the fort, if you like.
Sean, great to talk to you.
Thank you. Cheers.
You don't automatically think Laois when you think of GAA hurling or football finals or sporting stars of track, field or ring.
Now it opens up for Laois and the chance for the point, and over it goes.
But there's a strong and healthy spirit of sport here, a refreshing mix and openness that you don't find everywhere. You feel that energy the moment you step onto the campus at Scoil Creasth Rí in Port Laois, where county sporting legend Pat Critchley taught for many years.
Pat Critchley here in, appropriately enough, in basketball courts, this really impressive school campus where two schools came together. What about 1,500 students and an amazing ethos of sport in the school, reflecting, I think, the ethos of sport in the county. For you as a coach, as a trainer, would you put the emphasis on winning or on the individual enjoying what they do and being the best that they can be?
You coach the person first and the sport or the subject after. Like, and then there's another expression I always use, that when I'm doing coaching courses with coaches, they don't care how much you know until they know how much you care. So once you make a connection with somebody and they feel that you're interested in them and the development, and team success comes from that then.
Your own journey in sport, you obviously took to sport from a young age, and you made your mark in hurling and football and basketball, like across this range of sport. I mean, you obviously love all of it.
Yeah, and we just played everything, and we made up games. And because we played every game, there was a lot of versatility and this thing of specialising kids when they're young, you know. I think the AFL in Australia went on that track, and now they're going back, and they're getting a broad range. And then for youngsters as well to try out all sorts of things, to find what they like, you know.
Yeah, because you won't like everything.
You're not going to like everything. If you don't like sport, get into music, get into drama, get into what do you like doing, you know. For myself, when I went to primary school, Brother Summers, all his mottos stuck with me all my life with regard to playing sport and coaching sport. He had little mottos like the referee is always right, even when he's wrong. So you just get on with it, you know. And if you get a bang, he said, play the ball, you know. Bury a goal, put it over the bar, pass it on. You can lie down then after if you have to. You know? So we never lay down, like we never come off injured, you know, and we just kept getting on. So all those
things. So again, that thing of resilience
and,
built
and,
in.
And sportsmanship.
And clean sport.
Spirit of sport, yeah.
And you were saying that some of the youngsters would have a record of winning basketball, hurling, and football, like they take the three.
And the soccer even here as well. And now the volleyball is kicking back in.
Sport, Pat, as I suppose a source of integration. I think it's something that's very striking and something you're really aware of.
Yeah, that's it. In the old school, remember, the very first migrants, the Vietnamese girls who came to our school, they had to flee that war zone at the time, and were very motivated in trying circumstances. All their parents spoke Vietnamese at home, and then over the years, like, there was Polish migrants came in, and we had a brilliant volleyball team. Volleyball was huge in Poland, and we got the advantage of that, like, and right up to today when we're playing under 16 All-Ireland Cup game at 12 o'clock, and Margarita Shabanova is playing with us from Ukraine, having come from the most recent war zone.
And everyone benefits in the end.
It does, yeah.
Leash is lucky to have you, Pat.
You
want to hear that. You didn't want to hear that. That is true. Back to Port Arlington, near the French church and the derelict market house, your eye is caught by a large and striking mural. Two young boys on horseback, a somehow familiar image, and then you remember. It's Tato and Ozzy from the memorable 1992 film Into the West.
What's his name?
He's called Tiernanog.
But why is he called that?
Because he came from a land under the sea.
And appropriately, the mural is on the front of what used to be the town's Savoy Cinema, where part of that film was made. Artist Adam Warren, who's also known as ADW, also brought us the Spirit of Leash mural in Rathdowney.
Hello, Vincent.
Adam, great to meet you.
Good to meet you, Vincent.
Yeah. Outside the Savoy. And your very striking image on the front, tell me about it.
This is a piece of art that was inspired by the movie Into the West, where there were some famous scenes shot from the movie in this cinema. Yeah, very memorable scenes, also very memorable in the community when we were painting it. an awful lot of people came out and had their stories about the few days that the film crew were in town. And it was about 4 years ago now, so it's still weathering pretty well, although could possibly do with a fresh lick of paint.
So Tito and Ozzy on their horse,
yeah,
heading west into the west.
Exactly.
Had the cinema been derelict for long before that?
If I can remember correctly, I think the last movie was in 93.
Okay.
And then it had been sitting idle and unloved for a good few years.
And is there a possibility longer term then of the building being given a new use for artists?
Yeah, we have been trying our best. It's ticking along in the background. There's an art collective, the Port Art Collective, started last year, and there's probably about 50, 60 artists, from dancers to theatre to artists to musicians, and it'd be great to have a space where everyone can showcase their talents within the town. There wasn't much of an art scene 17 years ago. I think historically rural counties in Ireland are very sports influenced. So if you were in any way creative, you probably didn't hang around in the local towns too much. And I think it's changed a hell of a lot in the last few years.
For you, I just wonder, you know, you've lived here about, what, 17, 18 years. What's your spirit of Leash?
This is home now. Yeah, I do love it here. You know, I'm part of the community. I think painting the Into the West piece was a big thing. Instead of the crazy guy going around with painting clothes on, I'm the crazy guy that goes around with painting clothes on that did this. And then other bits around the town as well.
So plenty of walls to paint. Plenty of art to make.
I have my eye on a few more. I would love to get a little bit of a street art festival going myself, try get some more artists countrywide, and even some international artists would be great to start mixing it up, you know, making connections that aren't always there.
I mean, if Banksy can do it.
Yeah, exactly, yeah.
Why not yourself?
Exactly. Yeah.
Electric Picnic brings crowds of music fans to Laois each year, just as the Ploughing Championship brings farmers and a focus on farming life. Near Emo Court, that great house and gardens designed by James Gandon, I meet a group of very talented, determined and focused young musicians who make their own unique sound and have their eyes firmly fixed on the future. Meet Dopamine.
Hello, fellas.
I'm Sean Fleming, I do lead guitar and I sing on some of the songs.
I'm Juan Miguel de Borda and I'm the lead singer and rhythm guitarist.
I'm Sean Woods and I'm the drummer for the band.
Hi, I'm Chris and I'm the bassist.
And together you're Dopamine. Who came up with the name?
We liked it because dopamine is the chemical in the brain that triggers like addiction and enjoyment.
We want you to be addicted to our music. So.
Exactly.
Do you all study music in school?
Yeah, most of us, the way we learned how to play instruments is from teachers outside of school, because they don't actually teach you how to play instruments inside school. Yeah. I don't want to throw shade or anything, but they're not very good at it. So.
I'm actually fully self-taught off YouTube. It was very hard learning at first, but once you get a passion for like music and guitar and stuff, it gets a lot easier.
I really like Lost in Luxembourg, and there's a good story about how that song came to be, isn't it?
My dad, he went to Luxembourg and they got lost, and when he was telling me this story, he said like Lost in Luxembourg, and I don't know, I thought that it was quite cool, like almost a cheesy little song name. And I presented one with like a story of almost a guy gets an argument with his girlfriend, gets kicked out into the streets, they're on a holiday in Luxembourg, and now it's his thoughts. It was unrelated to the story completely, but I like the name. You made me such a fool, I'm wandering around these streets,
but all these memories just repeat. I suppose a lot of people, when they think about Laois, think about Electric Picnic. Has that been anything of a kind of symbol that has in any way inspired you?
Laois has a huge music scene. There's a lot of rock bands coming out of Laois, surprisingly. But I suppose Electric Pygmy would definitely be a big goal.
Longer term, what are your ambitions? What are your hopes?
Obviously, you want the fame and stuff. It's definitely, at the moment, writing. And we just want to get songs out there because we feel we have a new sound to give at the moment.
My favourite part being in a band is the money.
The experience together, honestly, it's an indescribable feeling. Like, you can't get it anywhere else.
It's a different bond, you know, when you're just, like, friends with each other and then, like, friends through music, I find. Like, you get so much closer and, like, you're expressing, like, the ideas that, like, that you just can't do with words, you know what I'm saying?
Back on the barge in Vicarstown with Philip Crean of Barrowline Cruisers, I think about how I love this place with its calm, undramatic landscapes, its quiet, determined people, humour never far from reach.
When you think of Laois, Philip, what do you mainly think of?
I think of the canals and the rivers. We're out here in the middle of nowhere. You can hear nothing else. Life just slows down.
There's an edge of industry here, a sense of unfussed drive and determination. The new has always been built and remade here. Laois may be landlocked, but its people are open-hearted and driven. Energy courses through the place with the river and canal water. That energy will be harnessed again. There's a lot to be made and done here, and a great deal to treasure and protect.